Well, my name is Marcien Lafortune. I was born at Woodridge, Manitoba, on December 26, 1912. Well, my father then, my grandfather was a justice of the peace down there in Woodridge, but they came to Canada a long time before that. My father was 5 years old when he moved into this country, but mother was born here in San Vital.
What was your mother's name?
Eugenie Gay. She was born right close to the Red River, near the between St. Anne and St. Mary's Road there, near Major Drive. Really, it would be Major Driveway. That's the first house. Second house is right by the bank, right at the intersection. Now, they took it apart.
What was your dad's name? What was his
father's? Abraham Gay.
Was he the first one here, or did his father?
He was the first one, I think. On my mother's side, I think he was the first one that came here.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
What did your grandfather have on his day do?
Pardon?
What did grandfather
age? He was a farmer here.
He was a farmer.
Yeah, he had a dairy and everything, and he was a veterinarian also, you know. There's a lot of people that came here, they were English and everything, like the Smith's family that lived the other side of the Assiniboia Downs right today. They still live on there. In fact, I have a friend of mine that we were working in custom together. Well, that was his grandfather that lived there, you know, and he was in the Air Force.
And Abraham Gates, you don't know what year this came in?
I couldn't tell you when, no. I think it was in the late 70s, somewhere around the 1870s, somewhere around there. I couldn't say for sure.
And did he do all right?
Oh, yes, he was. He owned a big piece of property there, and used to let the Indians, they wouldn't burn his stacks, so he gave them 4 acres, you know, of land, where the Glenwood Collegiate, I believe, is in Sandytown. Well, he left them to be able to park there to go and trade at the Hudson Bay Post, you see, like that. Well, they never bothered him, and he got along pretty good with them. And my grandmother's sister, we used to call her Aunt Catherine. She used to be an interpreter for the Hudson Bay Company. Catherine, that was her name, yeah.
Yeah, and
she was a Champagne.
She was a Champagne.
Yeah, so was my grandmother was a Champagne.
And where did she go, Indian?
They were born here. And my grandmother and my auntie, they were born here.
So where did she go, Indian?
Well, here in Manitoba. Because there was very few white people here during that time. Yeah, she could. In different. I learned a few Indian things like why you sit, where you sit, when you sit, when you do a patashingi. That's in the Indian. You make the sign of the cross that way, you know. From her. Why you sit, when you sit, when you do a patashingi.
The name
of Father, the Holy Ghost, yeah.
Oh, that's in what language?
I think that was mostly in Cree, I believe, yeah. Or Soto, one of the two. Yeah. I believe that, you know, during that time, of course, I wasn't raised here, but during the time of my grandfather over here, they believe that they call it Tanfan, was about the fastest little horse there was in the country. And I believe that's what Louis Riel jumped on, because that horse came back and he was all played out 2 weeks after, you know, but he came back home.
Did your grandfather help Louis Riel?
I couldn't say that if he did or anything of the kind, but the grandfather had, you know, he was well known. He was like a monarch in his own rights, you know, over here, you know, because he owned quite a bit of property, and he had nice long white whiskers up to his belt, you know. He was a real Santa Claus, you know. Although he didn't have no education, but he was very thrifty and everything. Yeah. Yes, but I couldn't tell you where he came from. Mm-hmm. On my father's side, well, grandfather came from, my father was born at Quetzalcoatl, Quebec, but they lived in Magog, that's close to the U.S. border, and then they moved over here. They moved here, when my father was 5 years old, so he'd be 92 years old now.
Well,
you know, I believe that, you know, they always wanted to. We were a thriving people. We come from Acadian descent, you know. And as far as what my father could find out when he was tracing, we'd be about 300 and some odd years in Canada. You know, I couldn't say the exact amount, which I intend to find out. I heard that they came to Saint-Nicolas. From there they went to Cape Breton Island. From Cape Breton Island then they were taken as lost by our ancestors. That's stories from one generation to the other was told, you know. There were some of us, our family, you know, they were stranded all over the country, you know. Mm-hmm. Some landed in the United States, all over the country, you know, yeah. That's on my father's side, you know.
And you boys were the Redbridge, what was it like?
Well, you see, grandfather is the one that built the school there, you know, and built the church. He was a carpenter. He was just the peace. He was the postmaster. And he was everything, tax collector and everything, you know. Then he was contractor during that time, you know. He was contracting in wood and all that stuff. And, well, I was taught school by my aunt. So La Fortune taught La Fortune in La Fortune School. But since then, I think a fellow went and changed the name. They called it La Verandrie, if I'm not mistaken now, but the La Fortune School is still there. In fact, they didn't demolish, they only built around that school. They didn't demolish the old school.
And of course, you worked in the wood contracting with your dad?
Pardon?
You worked with that wood contracting?
That wasn't with my dad, that was my grandfather. But my father was always, he went to school, he went to Provence School over here and finished his education, then he went and worked on the railroad. And after that he came and moved at Woodridge, he was real estate, then he became justice of the peace in the place of my granddad, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what he was doing, you know. Sometimes he had to teach school and in place when the teacher was sick and all that, he was a school teacher also. He taught school in Woodridge also. And then after that we moved to La Broclie where he became secretary of the municipality. And then we moved to Winnipeg and he went to Minet for a while. And then he was auditor here and we moved to Hattiesville. And after that, you know, because you want to keep the, there was a big depression and we thought it would be better for us down there because things were not so good in the city for a big family like us, you know.
How many kids
were
you?
We were 14. When we moved to Hattiesville, we were only 12 kids, but then there was two more were born in the Hattiesville. And, well, that's where I became a contractor.
Yeah.
Start contracting in wood business and this and that. Yeah. And then I went to Arbor Vitae, and I was in the sawmill with the Boyle boys. Mm-hmm. Then I came back over here and worked on the farm at La Broclie, which, and then I went and joined the army.
What made you
join the army? I'll give you straight. It was raining and I was harvesting with Snoy Robert and Mr. Rivard and
Pelican
at Albany. I was working for Stan Roberts, Stanislaw Robert. And we came downtown and we were celebrating, you know. And I think I went and passed by where they were registering, and so did Stan. And there was Rajat, Snoy Rajat, and there, you know, and his brother, Mr. Ivo. But we passed by there, which is right at the corner. We were staying at the old Frontenac Hotel then. And I must have went and signed my name in there, I don't know.
You were feeling
no pain. I felt no pain. And the next morning, you know, I came back, and I came from my room, and I was sitting, and I was waiting for the beer parlor to open, you know, because I was thirsty. And all at once, somebody asked at the desk, he says, La Fortune around here, and Roberts, and all them. And Roy, I think, was involved, but I couldn't tell you exactly how many of us had signed in. And then the guy says, there he is down there. So he came down there, and I didn't feel like, well, he says, come on with us. He says, you sign in, and now he says, we have to take you to Minto Army. So they brought us down there, but the other guys, they left because most of them, like Stanislaus Robert, I think he had 9 kids, and the other one had 21, I think. And the other one, and they were big farmers. Stanislaus Robert, I think he was cultivating about 4,000 acres. So that's how I joined the army. No, it wasn't. And that's how I became, I was in the army. And then I was living at, I came back that night. They gave me a suit and a pair of shoes there, old Kitchener boot. I couldn't even put them on. I put them on, but they were hard, and suit, and it was awful. And then I went to do some walking with them, and by God, you know, they used to peel all my ankles. You know. I'm not the only one. Everyone was kicking about, and we bought most of our own.
The boots were so hard.
Oh, yeah, they were. Well, they had been dried up from 1914 or something like that. And then, it was pitiful, you know. But then we had to stay somewhere. So they found a place for us, and we were staying at Mrs. Rose de la Ronde on Notre Dame West, not very far from the corner here. And we used to walk or ride to Minto Armies, mostly walking, because we were earning only $1.10 an hour.
Oh, did you like it?
The army?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I enjoyed the army. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I usually put myself, you know, at anything I take. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy it. You know? I got along pretty good with the boys and everything in the car, you know.
Who went with you? You joined up. Who stayed with you? Were you the only one left out of that gang that signed in?
What? Yeah, the others, well, they didn't want them, what the heck, man, to support about 9 kids and their family and big farmers and everything. I was the only one that was left in it. Yeah. But, you know, I enjoyed myself. I used to go down there and lead the choir when we were having lunch, you know. I had big Pat O'Connor. He was a personal friend of mine, but he didn't come to Hong Kong with us, but he came to Jamaica. He weighed about 235, 6'4". He was a heck of a nice guy. And we, I had George LeBlanc. Oh, I had Jim Tom and all them, Moisey. They're personal friends, you know.
And what did you do, form choir?
No, we were just sitting, you know, having our lunch. A lot of us would start singing. And I used, but during that time, there was Cameron, the Royal Canadian Artillery, Royal Canadian Heavy Artillery, and the Winnipeg Grenadiers, and some of the headquarters there, you know, heavy artillery, all that stuff. And then during the lunch hour, then we would start off, you know, and sing songs. You'll smile a while and wish me luck as you wave me goodbye and all kinds of crazy things. I used to lead. I used to be in that corner there. Mm-hmm. On the, they'd call it the Northwest Corner. Mm-hmm. That's where I used to sit and start off. And we'd sing during the lunch hour. And mm-hmm. That was our pastime, you know. Mm-hmm. But they all knew me. As that goes.
Then you went to Port Alfred?
And then we went to Port Alfred after that. You know. Yeah, I belonged to Don Company. We had Major Hook was in charge of us. And mm-hmm. He was a nice man and a heck of a good commander. And after that, we left for Jamaica. Well, I really got drunk the night before I left for Jamaica. I had even phoned my cousin Joe Philippon mm-hmm. to come and pick me up in the taxi, and I went downtown. We were not supposed to get out of the barracks, you know. Mm-hmm. And I made some phone calls and everything, and then I went down there and I brought some bottles of whiskey, and you know, we're celebrating and everything, and here. Everybody used to meet us at the drill hall, and Big Father Connor wanted to show us how agile, what we had been drinking all day, you know, mm-hmm. and what we used to do. So I was doing a stand on his shoulders, you know, because we did PT, it was nothing for us to do PT. Mm-hmm. And I was standing on his shoulder like that, and all at once I kind of lost my balance, I went to go and fall, and he grabbed a hold of me by the legs, you know, and instead of that, that's where I busted my wrist, but I wouldn't report to the doctor because I was leaving mm-hmm. to go overseas. We didn't know where we were going. So I went down there and I was putting it under the cold tap, you know, all night. And then the next day I went and it disappeared, so they couldn't throw me out of it. So I went with the boys. went on the ship. We stayed there for about 3 days in Halifax before we went. We started off. We saw the princess of from Holland, you know.
Oh, yeah.
She arrived there with her ship, and we saw them, but we only saw the ship and her, you know, but we couldn't leave our ship at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get off it. We were on the Lady Drake.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we left for Jamaica. We passed by Bermuda, Cuba, and all that. When we came by Cuba, they met us, you know, with some gun boats and all that. We stopped in Bermuda and everything. Bermuda is a little island about a mile and a half long, and it's made of the coral. They even cut the coral off and they build these town houses out of it, you know, and everything. And, the whole place, you can swim practically any place, but there's a little danger, not too much danger for sharks and all that. But, and during that time, there was only horses. There was no cars or anything. But,
did you go to
Jamaica, you know.
Yeah.
And what we had down there was beautiful. We went to Jamaica, and there, that was the worst part. We ran out of cigarettes, and we didn't get paid, and all that stuff. We had some boys that bought a lot of cigarettes on the boat, and then they wouldn't share with the boys, even though that you promised them a lot of money. And Jamaica, it was a nice life. Women there, they love their husband more than that.
They do, they better women down there?
No, I wouldn't say that, but I say they, you know, they appreciate a man more. But they're very sociable. You know, the Jamaican people are a lot like Canadian, you know, they're very, I'll say Manitoban more so.
Yeah.
You know, they're very sociable,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they accepted us. You know, they were always with English or Scottish soldiers all the time, which they treated them like, you know,
like
while we went and mixed in with them, which was a lot better, you know.
And they
really appreciated us a lot, you know. They enjoyed our company. I knew the DeCastrises, and they made Mr. Vaughn of the Vaughn Biscuit Company. He made the first party for the Canadian Union. He gave me privilege to invite, so I brought the orchestra, the band boys down there, and some of my favorite friends like Corbett and Fred Lively and these guys, you know. Manchester and Marsh, Sergeant Marsh, Sergeant Manchester, you know, to come to these places. And quite a few people gave me some nice parties, and they were very nice, you know, to us. Then in the Kincaid family,
mm-hmm.
used to know them, you know, they had the only drugstore there, which Dr. Crawford and Major Hook used to go, and Padre Askey.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a wonderful man, Padre Askey. Crawford was a good man, and Hook was a good man. And Sutcliffe was a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
He was a real soldier, you know. Yeah. Well, we had, I'll tell you, we had a nice class of officers.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is true, you know. You always find some there, maybe more regimental in certain things, and then me. You know, as a general, we had a nice bunch of officers, you know. And we had good sergeant major. Old Paddy King was a pretty good man, you know, regiment sergeant, Sergeant Major Adams and all them.
Okay, tell me about going to Hong Kong.
Well, when we came back over here, you know, it was no fun to come back. We came back over here and, you know, we didn't know where we were going. So we left while we had a little time off here. And we left to go to Hong Kong. We went on the train. We didn't know where we were going. We were lectured about a few things. We didn't know where we were going. So then when we came aboard the ship, they unloaded us down there. It was the Awatia. I was in charge. Sergeant Long put me in charge of mostly all the Indians that was in Don Company. And the guys like, there was a Nepal, Indians and the new recruits, you know. And bad.
Were you a prophet?
No, I was supposed to be something, but I never was. And I'd lose it.
You lost it.
I'd lose it before I'd have it. But when the officers had about three quarters of the ship, and we were not allowed to even promenade on the promenade deck, and we stayed a little walk off. Oh yes, it came pretty bad. Bowman was in the orderly officer then, but young Matty and I, we walked off the boat, but we came back on. I think there's only a few that never came back because we were sleeping and eating at the same place in the hammocks. Oh, well, the one of the officer, Bowman, he's passed away now. He said, "What about me?" He said, "I have to share the same bath with another officer, you know, but he can't be in your bath all the time." When we went on the Awatea, it's a New Zealand ship, and it was about 18,000 tons ship, you know, big ship. And it wasn't loaded, there was only us guys on there and a few of their only troops, which we didn't mix in very much with. They kept us apart. And the ship was top heavy, you know, there was nothing in the hold. So we started off, and then there was this, what they called the Prince Robert, was the one, I believe, that came to escort us down. There was a little destroyer that came to escort us down. And they, while we stopped in Honolulu, you know, they start to feed us all this tripe, whatever they call it, the sheep belly or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. We started to go ba ba ba. There was very little liquor on it, you know.
It wasn't so hot for you guys.
No, we didn't like it so much, you know.
Did you have a little revolution?
No, we didn't, you know. We took it. You know, as long as we had some officers down there, you know, they just had to show themselves, and we had a lot of respect for them. You take Major Hook when we came back from Jamaica, you know. He let us free in Montreal, and he had no rights, and he says, "I want every one of you to be back here at 6 o'clock. And you know, there was one guy who was waiting for 6 o'clock with big gangi, and he was puffing and coming down there. I said, "There he is." And you're like, "Oh yeah." And there wasn't one that disappeared on him. You know, I mean, the boy stayed. Yeah, he said that he wanted to go and see. But Major Hook, you know, he had a way with men. So was Crawford and Sutcliffe and Norris and Captain Gresham, Burkett. They were... and all the boys did. You take like Neil Bardell, you know, there was Captain White, you know, the Phillip boys, they were all good soldiers, in action and otherwise, you know.
So when did you get the idea you're going to be a Roman
Hawkman? Well, we got the idea after we left Manila. And then we were going. I was quite a bit in the crow's nest, you know. And I saw two submarines coming on the side, on each side. I had a good eyesight, you know. And I gave the signal and everything, and I'll tell you right, that everybody was in action in a very short while. You know, of course, we all drilled for that. Yeah, and we drilled after we learned that. Well, we were drilling in self-defense and everything by the Kelso brothers.
So what about the submarines?
Well, they were Americans, but we didn't know, you know. I didn't know anybody, but we found out they were American subs, you know, in there. But then we reached Manila, you know. We never, in the Pearl Harbor or Hawaii, you know, there's some of the guys that jumped off. We were swimming around there. Of course, we just took a chance. We were not supposed to, and then they called us back. We came back, but I think we lost a couple guys on the way, you know. They were mostly all new recruits. They were not old-timers of the Grenadiers, you know. Because we picked up some guys from South Saskatchewan Regiment, the Cameron, the PPCLIs over here when we came back from Jamaica. And then we went to Manila and everything, you know. I can remember when we saw, you know, there's a clock when you arrive there and everything in the harbor. And so we saw that and all that. They received us down there, which in Hawaii and there. you know, they come to meet all ships, and they give us a little tune and dance and so on and so forth. But we couldn't get off, you know. Some of our officers went out.
They couldn't get you back on?
No. Well, I don't know. No, I think, I will say this, you know, I think they had, you know, the officers were pretty good with the men. So I believe, I don't think it would be that much here. Of course, we had a few that stayed behind.
Tell me, how about when you arrived in Hong Kong?
When we arrived in Hong Kong, you know, we arrived in the morning and I was out. When we left Honolulu, there was Morris Pearson and I, we were in the back and we saw the nice beautiful moon and he was singing at the lower deck and I was singing at the moon down there in the back. Morris Pearson, young Morris. He had a good voice too, that fellow. And we're singing and we're going down. And when we arrived in Hong Kong, well, I was off early, you know, I was those inquisitive fellows, so I saw them. And we're waving goodbye to San Pan. They thought we were calling them and they were trying to catch us. The Awatea was faster than our escort. We got there before the escort, you know. And at least that's what we were. I think it was the Prince Robert. And I think we got another escort from Manila, but I couldn't tell you exactly now who it was that escorted us out. But well, after that we came there, of course, you know, when I came there I had the hemorrhoids. Before I left Winnipeg, I didn't walk to the station, they drove me to the station. And I still had them, you know. And so they brought me in a truck to the barracks, I didn't have to walk. And so when we came, they brought us to Shamshapu. Boy, the stink that was there. If you think that Gardas was dirty, you should go. And that's the main parts of the thing we were going in, the best parts. Because we got off at across, not Hong Kong, Kowloon side. And then we helped to unload some of the stuff. You know, I was one detail down there, and then after that we went with the truck. And we arrived there. Well, none of our cooks knew how to handle these pots and to cook for us, so they left us a sergeant and a couple of corporals with the Royal Scot guards, you know. And Jock Wilson was one of them. And they showed the boys how to use these big steel pots all covered with, which I have in the picture here, you know, they're there, you know, how to cook the rice and so on and so forth, and how to use these stoves because they're very old-fashioned. It was the same thing in Jamaica, you know, everything was so old-fashioned, it isn't even funny, the bunks and everything, it was pitiful, you know. Very old-style steel beds and full of lice and everything, the same thing in Shamshapu camp. That's where we were stationed.
What you guys did, clean it up?
Well, we cleaned all what we could, you know. We did everything, the same thing. In Jamaica, we used to bring, to clean these things, we used to bring ants, but in China, there's not as many ants as in Jamaica. We used to bring a little sweet stuff to the bed, you know, and let the ants, I could lay down there and let the ants go all over me, but they clean all the bed bugs and everything, you know. We had medical when we arrived there, you know, we had some medical supplies and everything, but then they didn't give us no money again. We always had trouble to get our money, you know, always something. So the first night we went out, well, we call it the Battle of Sun Sun. That Sun Sun was a cafe, and the English regiment, they wanted to show us Canadians off, so we had a little battle down there. The Laurie and a fellow, an English fellow by the name of Teasdale, they were there. Laurie used to hold him up and Teasdale would hit him. And we had the Battle of Sun Sun. The guy wouldn't even charge us. He says, Canadians, he said, they're better spenders than all the others. I got cut up a little bit, you know, taking the bottle at the other guy. And, we never say these things, do we?
No.
I don't know, but We had our own few scratches, you know.
Did the FCs break out?
We had no more left. So the only thing we threw down the Wurlitzer down the thing, you know.
Down the service?
Yeah. But the guy wouldn't even charge us for it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's the same at the Palace Hotel. It was American and the Peninsula Hotel. And so the officers as well, they said, these privates are corporate, it's only an officer should be allowed in here. Well, he says, hey, he said, these guys spend more in one night than you spend in a month.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, what have you got to say, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we were well treated, and of course it was all new,
mm-hmm.
everything, you know.
What did you think of Hong Kong yourself? When you first looked at it, the Canadians coming from Canada.
Well, I'll tell you, Hong Kong, you know, for people, you know, they're so... to me, Hong Kong is a place, you know, it's a port, and you go to Halifax, it's something different than Winnipeg. And down there, it's a port, and it's very international. It's a big port, you know. Singapore is another big port. Manila is a big port. You know, that's ships from all over the world, you know. Madame Kowloon's side is a little different, although there's only about a mile and a half different apart, you know, just... But... to me, you know, I'll tell you, you know, that life like that, you think about the stink of Los Angeles and all that, down there it stinks a lot worse than that and everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can't trust even the water, you can't trust nothing, you know, it's nothing to get disease. You see people begging, you think they're really suffering with leprosy and everything, but they do that because they make their living by begging, they're professional beggars. Women come down there, their husband maybe have a little store or something, make good living. They come with their kid to beg from you, and they pinch him to make him cry. He's hungry. And they used to say, come saw, all the time.
What are people living on
the streets? Oh, they're living. They used to send a patrol all the time to pick the dead, you know, in daytime, you know, what died during the night, you know, and everything of the kind. And, it's a different world completely. I wouldn't give a half my half acre for the whole of China. Of course, you know, this in China, to my way of thinking, and I met a lot of people and I have a lot of friends there. My way of thinking of China, it's an old nation that they're very angry at each other, don't trust, no trust with each other or anything of the kind. There's no feeling for one or the other, you know. If a person is dead, has gold teeth, they don't want to touch him because it's only, you'd have to bury him if you touch him. They just leave him there. It's nothing for dead people or anything, starvation. I think there's more people with more money than what we have here, but they don't care. Where there's the most money, there's more starving people.
Mm-hmm. Big disparity between the two people.
Yes,
and
they have so much class distinction. You take, we'll see only in Carpenter, from one that saws, hold the nail for the other one to a hammer, to the one that saws and the one that measures and everything, that's all a class distinction all the way through. From the Enoch up to a coolie, all women have no respect for women, 10, 12-year-old women or anything like that. They have to make their living. I've seen little girls about this high, about, let's say, 2.5, 3 years old, 4 years old, have to work for a living, while the little boy is sitting down there with his father, you know, and enjoying everything. Sometimes, you know, I don't know, but there was one time after we were prisoners. I'm going over my thing, but we were prisoners and we were digging tunnels, and we came there and they had all that back chow, you know, which is not quite ripe enough, you know, to bring on the market, but the Japanese came down there and made him wipe that off, and there was a little girl and she was sweating and she was working, and the little boy was in the kind of a tent to go down, you know, they lived these gardeners in there, you know. And the father was there and all the women were picking it up and they were crying, and the Jap, come on, clear that off, and we were digging in there, you know, we're digging tunnels for them to hide themselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it was pitiful.
Tell me, where were you and what was the kind
of... Down there, right in Hong Kong.
And what were you doing that day? Do you remember that day?
Yes, sir. I was, that was early in the morning. I was a CB because I went out, I broke out of barracks. And I was one of these bad boys, you know, but not dangerous. I broke out of barracks, that was that night, you know, then the fight after, the night after the fight. And I was CB'd, and here we saw, we heard all that, we were doing some maneuvers, we thought, and all at once, you know, they brought some guys, we were waiting for them, and all at once the airplanes came. Well, this is nice maneuvers, we're looking at them, just seemed like you're looking at the Canada Goose coming back, you know. Oh, I said, that's nice maneuvers. All I've done, they draw bombs. I says, hit the ditch, boys. And then there was Major Baird, and he came down there and said, come on, draw ammunition. We had the Lance Corporal there. And then, you know, he got excited because none of us were so used to it. But you see, I was running men. I was foreman before I ever joined there. Well, automatically it came about. You know, you did self-preservation, you know, and could give a command, and that was it. So I hit the ditch, you guys, for crying out loud, and that's exactly what happened. And we were only about, let's say, 100 feet where they hit the canteen there, and some guys went down there already trying to get a few cigarettes. And then when they issued the ammunition, we didn't have a bandolier for each man. And then we were waiting for the boat to take us. But during that time, you know, I had a piece of shrapnel or something that went right through here. And then maybe scratched the bone, you know, and that's about all I had there. And, we went to Hong Kong and Ireland. Went on a kind of a barge, you know, trail. But we didn't have very much ammunition with us, so that's where we moved to Hong Kong, and then we went close to Stanley Gap, and then we were in
what company were you in then?
Don Company. Don Company, all the way through. I stayed with Don Company all the way through.
Who was your corporal in charge right then, in that fight?
Oh boy, and the corporals were, you see, they took some maneuvers. We thought it was for maneuvers. They took some out before that, you see, and we were going to go after. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know that we were going to be attacked. We thought it was maneuvers. Mm-hmm. I believe our officers the same thing, thought the same thing, you know, but it wasn't that.
It was a complete surprise.
It was a complete surprise, you know. It was on the 8th of December, the same thing, you know. So we went over down there, and they brought us to Stanley Gap, and there we were. It was Corporal Woods. Myself there, Jimmy Lowe, Maxwell, Fred Lavely, Sergeant Major Adams, Lieutenant Corrigan, and Don Company was in that region, but we're divided into sections, you know, because all companies have platoons and sections, yeah. You see. So we were there, and all at once they were bombing. We'd take pot shots of the airplanes and everything of the kind, you know, try our luck. And
then
one day,
pardon? No ground attack yet.
Oh, yeah, well, not, they were attacking, but 21 miles before that, we went with Mr. Mitchell, Lieutenant Mitchell, and we walked 21 miles out, and we saw there was about 60,000 troops there. We don't know how many, but they were just immense, you know. They were, that was China, and they owned that part, you know, Canton and all that, you know. But it's this side of Canton, between Canton and Kowloon. And we walked back.
How did you feel?
What? Oh, well, we were pretty used to it, you know, because we did a lot of walking. You think we trained.
No, but I'm talking about when you saw all those troops.
Well, we didn't know they were going to attack us. They were Japanese. We were not at war with Japanese or anybody, you know. In fact, you know, what I had, and they told us the people there and everything of the kind in which we got acquainted very fast. They told us that there was a lot of Gurkhas there, and there was about 6,000 troops that left the place, and they had been stationed for a long time. They only left the Royal Scots and the Middlesex there, and a few Air Force guys and a few Navy affairs. Yeah, that's about all, you know. They didn't have them. They had the Hong Kong Volunteer Corps, which there was about, let's say, 500 to 600 of Royal Scots, somewhere around there, and 300-400 Middlesex, and about 300 Indians, Punjabs, Rajputs, and then there was about maybe 200-300 volunteers, Hong Kong volunteers, which that's one of the lieutenants that made this book here. But, you know, we'd never thought, I believe we fought. My Don Company was the first in action. We went to, supposed to relieve the Royal Scots in the Middlesex, but already they had retired because that was too much for them, you know, that was complete suicide, you know. Mm-hmm. We lost two men on that way.
What was that, a
Sandy
Gap?
No. That was 21 miles off. Mm-hmm. But we didn't go that far. We went about here. There's a picture of it here. Not very far from the camp. The Shamshapo camp.
Oh, yeah. Not far from there, right?
Well, you see there's a big road there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
You see that mountain?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Where we're stationed in here.
Oh, yeah. So you were still on the Kowloon side.
Yeah, but no, we had been in Hong Kong, but we were on the Kowloon side.
You pulled back up.
That's where Al Spires got the rupture there. He was carrying Al Spires. He's still living. Then when we retired, Captain Bowman was there, and we had a Bren gun carrier, and we were firing behind. But really, the Chinese people were hitting us more than the Japanese, and the Gray wanted to go and get himself a bottle, but he got hung right there. We couldn't do nothing to help him. And there was Shepherd that was left a little bit behind because he was scared, but we finally got him back, you know, on the Hong Kong side. But we retired to a Star Ferry. Yeah.
A lot of people were wounded there.
No. There was only Al Spires, like I say, and Gray that lost his life there.
Mm-hmm.
What were the Chinese doing? They were hitting us and everything, throwing stones. Well, that's their life, you know. The stronger has the... You know, that's their life. You know, they go with the strongest, you know, to prevent...
To survive,
you know. That's what it is, to my knowledge. Maybe I'm a poor judge, but this is what it is. If you read Pearl Buck a lot, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. It's not only fiction, you know. And I've read a few articles of that minister that went down there. They just gave him, they came to go and visit the place right now, these badminton players in Ontario, where he came in his house, where it was. He gave his life down there. You know, they tell the truth. The people are good and everything, but their survival is it's something like the wolf, you know. Well, if I can't get nothing, I'll eat you if you're weaker than I am, and that's exactly what it is, you know.
What happened after you left that?
We went to Hong Kong, and then we were fighting what we could, you know. We dropped, I think we were the ones that we dropped two airplanes. One went when we were near Mount Cameron, stationed there, and it went into the water, and the other one when we were at between Standing Gap, where Don Company was attacked by the Japanese that night, you know, on the 19th of December. I was under Corrigan then, you know. Yeah, and then after that they moved us.
What did you do? Were you that?
Oh, I was everything.
Were you
see
machine
or what? Oh, yeah, I was, well, I have my picture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you saw it the other day. I wasn't, you know, I mean, I was pretty good at it. I was good at night firing and all that, you know. We put on displays and this and that.
Oh,
for the
you were on the
well, no, I was mostly all the time in charge of somebody. That's the worst part of it. And I was promoted sergeant by Major Baird, but I didn't get it. He said they gave, when they came back, I went with Major Baird to see Tris, but he said they had given all the promotions that there was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as far, that's the army affair, you know. Well, then after that, we went and fought at Mount Cameron and everything. There's lots more, but it, you know, involved in like when I wasn't very far from where DeLorge and Holiday and Swanson, a friend of mine from Vassar, you know, but I couldn't do nothing, you know, because I didn't have nothing to defend myself, you know, to hit back at him. And I think Moisey, if you interview Moisey, he can tell you a little something about that too, or Jim Tom. I think they were not the same place where I was, but they were scattered a little bit, and I think, but we saw them, but we couldn't do nothing. Yeah, but we couldn't help them. No ways, because I wasn't even armed. Yeah. But after that, we went and fought, and we stranded at Mount Cameron, and then they started to shoot on us, and I was always in, seemed to be in charge of something, and this and that, you know. I was under Major Baird, and at Mount Cameron, I was under Captain White, and there was always something. At Mount Cameron, well, we fought down there, and I think we did a lot of ravaging there, because we had Farrell, Corporal Ford, got killed there, McLaughlin got wounded there, and Corporal Ford, there was, yeah, we were about 135, and six of us and one officer came out.
That was a tough fight.
Well, they sent me for more ammunition, but I went for more ammunition, but they didn't have enough to last until I come there, and then I was left alone, and I heard them down below, so I said, "You're Captain White, well, come on down." So I went down, and there, as I had a Bren gun carrier full of ammunition this side, so I threw one that side, threw one that side, started to go, and I hit. I fell down a ditch. You know, from the mountain, there's water that comes. Finally, there's a kind of a waterfall.
Yeah.
But it was dry, you know, semi, just a little bit of water in it, you know. It wasn't torrential rain. It was raining that day, you know. We had been there for about 2 days. It was raining that day, you know. We had been there for about 2 days. And then I fell down there. And then I could hear them yell for me, "Are you coming?" You know. But they were shooting, the Japanese were shooting at me then. I was advanced of my troops. I was down the hill before that, you know, ahead of my troops to see if they were coming or not. We had seen them all day long. You know. But after that, we went down. I finally reached the bottom. Everybody was retiring to Mount Austin. We didn't know if it was Mount Austin. They were there. So there was Corporal Dan. He was wounded and we stayed behind with him and Staff Sergeant Seymour. I think Corporal Dan is still alive. And we finally followed the others because I had kind of busted back, you know, and then they were firing those shells to keep the enemy away from us, which we had 2 howitzers there, you know. And when they fired these shells, so they hit me. But it's only, I couldn't say if it was only my shells also, but they were throwing transmortar machine, you know. I was hit here and there, you know, but not severe, but my back was kind of broken off, you know, because I fell in there. Although I couldn't say, you know, when you're in action, you can't.
So many things happen.
Yeah, no, you're all working on nerves, and you don't know. For instance, about 2 days before that, Jimmy Young, they had quite a battle there. Well, I wasn't there with him, Advance Hill of us. And he was with the headquarters, he was with C Company previous to that, but he was with the headquarters, I believe. And they had quite a battle, and they were hand-to-hand fighting, and he passed me. He didn't know he passed me or anything. He was wounded right through the lung, shot through the lung, you know. he lives here on Ebbe. And he passed us, but he was going straight to the first aid, on his own.
On his own.
Yeah, and they left him dead, for dead, you know. Well, you take like what Sweet and all that, he dragged himself, he was shot, and he lost an arm and everything, and he dragged himself all the way through. The same thing, there was a little fellow by the name of Popeye. He was shelled from shell bombardment. He had one arm missing and one leg and part of his face. And he dragged himself that way, you know. You know, nerves make you go through a lot of that, you know. Yeah.
You're sort of in shock.
Yeah. I was in charge of some of the boys when we retired from Mount Cameron about 3 days before that. Two days, I think, or something. The night after I met Jimmy Young, and we retired from Mount Cameron, they were shelling us, and there was no officer around. We had only Tugby, and he had disappeared. And so I had to take charge of it. So I said, "All right, come on, let's go down." I says, "We have no orders to do anything, you know." So we went down. And we went to lay down into headquarters. We wanted to know what we were going to do, you know. And we went and laid down in the building that was shelled. Well, it didn't bust through the building. But if you're in here and the shell hit that wall, you'd die over here from the concussion only. And here we laid down. It was dark, of course, you know, and everything. And we laid down down there. And here in the morning, I woke up. You know, in the morning, well, it, a couple hours, I woke up, there was two dead men, one Chinaman and one Middlesex Royal Army Service Corps, I think, one on each side of me, and they were all bloated. You get bloated that way when you're concussion, you know.
And you were alive.
Eh?
And you were alive.
Oh, yeah, but we came there after they had been shelled.
Oh, yeah, you didn't know that.
It was Arsenal and I. Before we went to Mount Cameron, we were left down there to hold the fort. And the Arsenal had yellow jaundice. I didn't know that. And we held the fort down there, but then they started to give us sea bombardment. And they were shelling that place. And do you know that it took us from about 5 o'clock in the morning till 11 at noon, when we crossed the road, and it was only about 150 feet to cross, but the shells were coming so fast we didn't know if we'd be hit until we crossed, you know. Well, there was only Arsenal and I. They gave us some Hong Kong volunteers, but most of them disappeared during the night because they didn't know. We received a mule cart that passed by through Arsenal and I, but Arsenal had yellow jaundice. After that, he went to the hospital. But there was, but after Mount Cameron, we were reunited at Mount Austin, and then they sent us to Aberdeen Reservoir, last stand. At least we didn't know it was. It was a fight to the finish. We were under Captain White again and Captain Bardell. And we went down there, and most of us guys were dead end kids, they used to call us. George Lamoureux, Nixon, Herbie Forge, and George LeBlanc Bradshaw, and all these guys, you know. Morris Peterson and George Peterson and Long Tom. Long Tom never was one of the dead end kids, but he was a good guy. Fred Lavallee was in there. I never mentioned him. Slow Jackson, Corporal Jackson, he was a good guy. He died before he arrived. But Morris was with us there at the same time. And then we went ahead of them, you know. And then they established, you know, Captain White, between Captain White and Captain Bardell, you know, they knew what they were doing, you know. Captain White was a real soldier. And so was Bardell, you know. He was not one of these guys spit and polish regiment, but he knew what he was doing. He had good brains, you know. And Corrigan the same thing, and Burkett. Burkett told the boys, he says, "Move through, boys. Come on, I'll watch it." And he stayed there, but they killed him. And there was lots of guys. The Mitchell brothers, the same thing. The same thing with the Phillip boys. You know, they're both, one is blind completely, and the other one, all, they're both crippled. They live there in Vancouver now. They were real good fellas. You know.
That's, were you captured, or was that where you
were supposed to live? No, there we fought, and we saw them coming and everything, and then it was all arranged before and all that. And then all at once, Captain White said, "You go and get Tom and Moisey." And they were the last ones at that end, you know. And there was Nugent and that Van Silamont Bennett. We were right in front of Mount Reservoir, the Aberdeen Reservoir. And we didn't know that Bailey was behind us, you know, with his seed company troops. And here, now at once he says, "All right," he says, "go and get them, come on." And they had range, and when we gave the last men that went through, hooray, well, he was, Captain White was the last one, and I was just ahead of him. But we lost Corporal Andrews. No, not Andrews, I forget what's his name now. Oh, he was a friend of mine. He fell down there, and he hurt himself, you know. And we had to drag him through, you see. So when we came through, then we said, and he yelled fire, and then they started to fire. Well, you should have heard the screams of these Japanese, you know, and everything of the kind. And we fought through the night there and everything. And so that's where Corporal Jackson got wounded. And and we were stationed there, and the next morning we went and looked at all this stuff. You should have seen, they were piled high. You know, they came down there. We used to shoot the officers, and after that let them come. And they were like a man going without, a truck coming without a man, you know, driving, you know, just keep on going. You know. It was pitiful. At Mount Carmen, we could visualize all that, you know, shoot the side guys, and after that they keep on coming, you just could wipe them off.
That was again.
Yeah.
They just never stopped.
No, well, the fighting men, I think, I believe, to me, you know, because I've seen that, that'll come after. I believe they were all doped.
Oh, I've heard that before.
Yeah, I believe they were all doped. Well, then we fought there and everything, and the next day, that was on the 24th, we went there on the 23rd, I believe, 24th and 25th of December. And on the 25th of December, they raised the flag. So we stayed there during that night, and I buried, they told us to throw all our arms, ammunition, so we dismantled everything and broke this and broke that, you know, and threw it around and buried some. So I had what they call a Bren gun, a carrier, not a carrier, it's a kind of a satchel form, a steel box, you know, that we put the Bren gun magazines full, you know, ready to shoot with. And I put some shells for a 38 and the Luger that I had then. And I buried the Aberdeen Reservoir. I think if I would have went last time, you know, I think I could have went and found it again. But I buried it there. And with oil and everything, in case I could escape, we could go and get it. So we came, and that night they came, and we were sleeping there. I'm not a hard sleeper at any time. And we were watching, and they were coming to inspect us and everything of the kind. There's a fellow I want to give a lot of credit to, you know, when he went with the flag, to raise the flag, you know, that we had surrendered. He was a batman, it's not Benson, it's Hobson. Batman had a lot of credit, you know. In between him and Ashton, today they call him, and his name is Robertson. But they were, I have to give them a lot of credit to that.
They were real fighters.
Yeah, and Corporal Jackson. Slow Jackson was a real man, you know, long down for his length and size, you know, 6'6½", you know, that man. Mm-hmm. McLaughlin, 6'5½", you know. They were a big target, you know, these guys, you know. Through the my sight, I saw Red Eakins on the island where he got shot, and the Japanese were running around him like this, you know, and they, like you heard about Giant on the beach. Yeah. Well, he was bloated up because he was killed like the night before, and after that, you know, you kind of blow up, you know, during the day, you know, or something after you're dead, you know. And it was making, he was a guy that weighed about 265. You can imagine these little Japanese. You look in the book, you see the difference, and that's about their average size. You can see the size of a Japanese man. And these guys, you know, they were nothing. We fought them. They wanted to know what kind of maneuver we were doing. Well, we were fighting Indian style. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole thing. And, you know, they jump falling stuff like this. Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, just like gorillas, but they were little things. At first, you know, we didn't know what they looked like in the first place, you know, how they were dressed or anything, you know. It was, we could have shot our own troops as far as we know, you know. But these guys, you know, really, it was, but after we knew them, we got in contact with them at cemetery, hand-to-hand fighting, and that's how we knew them. And I think the first time I saw them, and I'm not sure yet today because it was dark when we were with Corrigan. I believe there's some Japanese that passed through. Mm-hmm. Okay. Us.
Oh, sure.
But I couldn't say for sure. Mm-hmm. Captain Corrigan is head postmaster at Swift Current. A heck of a nice guy. Brave. We fought Mon Cameron down there. He fought the hand-to-hand fighting, you know. And he, sure, his hand was with the officer, and he had the sword of the officer, and he killed the officer. He still has that sword, I think. Mm-hmm. No.
Tell me about how you.
So then after that, with the next day, you know, that we organized and we came to this. I don't know if that they call it one Shai or one Shang, because it's all mixed up. I never used to talk about this stuff, mm-hmm. and I never liked to talk about it. But then when we came there, well, the Japanese met us. We were on our own, you know. Mm-hmm. We didn't have no ammunition, but we packed all the food that we could get and some clothing and all that, and we came down there, and they made us to all our stuff. They came to us, some had rings and take it off, and their watches and everything. And then they put us in V formation, and they put one machine gun there, you know. And all at once, you know, we were looking, and there was Big Paul was right there beside me there, and he's tall, and he had Major Hook's cap on, you know. And by golly, you know, they went down there, and by golly, they looked at him, you know, and the little guy got kind of shaky. Mm-hmm. The little guy, you know, only about that high, you know, mm-hmm. they're not tall. Again. He got kind of shaky to see all the tall guys that there was there, you know. Mm-hmm. And for crying out loud, man, you know, he went down there, and the corporal came and told him something, took a little jar and put some, took it, and after that, he was ready to take us all on. That's where I say they were taking dope.
Oh, yeah.
Whether we call it stay awake pill or whatever it was, you know, but it was. I couldn't say because I couldn't tell you exactly what it was.
You're
but,
the first guy
coming. And, then they were going to kill us, but the car came down there and stopped us. Major Bailey was with us that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Captain White and Captain Bardell. And all of us, we just picked the clothes that we could, you know. Mm-hmm. But this affair, you know, of not being scared, well, I don't care. I think I carried my... I think I pooped in my pants and I carried it for a couple of days until I could change them. That's not so nice to say, but it's true.
Tell me about when you went to prison.
Well, from there we went and they loaded us with all kinds of stuff after they stopped us and they made us move. And we went over Mon Cameron. That's where they lost the most there, you know. They erected the monument down there in Hong Kong, you know. On account, they claimed that they lost 8,000 casualties and 3,000 dead. But
that's
down there,
the Japanese.
Japanese.
Yeah.
We climbed Mount Cameron, and it was slippery, raining and everything, you know. Not that day, but it was very slippery because the night before it rained. And we climbed that Mount Cameron, and I was carrying wheat fall down and everything, and boy, they were right behind us with bayonets, you know, and everything of the kind. That's where they want to take Seti. They thought he was Canadian, he was an Indian, from India, you know. They wouldn't believe him, honest to goodness. They were going to separate him and put him with the Indian Corps. You know. They didn't know he was Canadian. So we climbed Mount Cameron, and here they showed us, you know, they were already burning corpses, you know, they're, that's what they do, they burn their own soldiers, you know. And there were some Indians who were doing the work and everything of the kind. And then they brought us all down, and then they came back at the same spot where we were, climbing that hill and go around maybe. That's a march we had to do. And we walked all that night until they brought us, went through the town, we were walking over dead people and everything. What made the man stop the war, the governor there of Hong Kong, was on account they had no more water in town, you know. And they had shelled the water supply. We had the Aberdeen Reservoir, you know. That helped us. And so we went and walked all through that dead people, and finally they brought us to the Hong Kong Library or something. That's where we were stationed for just a little while. And we had no water. Finally they came sometimes about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, brought us some water. And about an hour or so after, they made us walk again. We went all around the town, and finally we went to Murray Barracks, and there we stayed that day, part of that day, and all that night. And some of us boys went to China Command, where we stole some. There's a fellow, George LeBlanc was in there, Bradshaw was there, Nixon was there, Fred Lavallee was there, myself, Herbie Fortune. Now, there's another one I want to give you his name, but I just right now, I can't remember his name. He's in Vancouver. He's a heck of a guy. But just the same. And we were drinking that night, and the next day, you know, they came to get us, and here we... I had an Air Force captain, Major... what's his name? Baird, you know, come, he hit it off. He said, what, do you want them to shoot you or something? He said, you're a Canadian, you shouldn't have that, you know. And I was insulted, and I was half drunk, you know, drugged up. So they made us walk again, and we went, and then they made us stand to attention because they passed with all their the ashes of their dead. They must have passed for about an hour and a half. And after that, they traversed us to Kowloon site. And every place we walked, the Chinese used to come down there. Some did come and hit us, some threw us bricks, some anything, you know. They'd come right at us, you know, and you couldn't do nothing to them, you know. And we were carrying whatever we had. We salvaged, you know, picked up here and there. And then we went to Argyle Camp, this Argyle Camp, but then it was full, they couldn't take us there. So we walked from Argyle Camp back to Kowloon by the Peninsula Hotel, and then they talked there for a long time, and then we went all the way through, which is about 7 miles. Argyle Camp is about 4 miles, and from there, all this walking, I don't know how many miles. Finally, we landed at the Kowloon, at Shamshapo. When we came there, well, we had hardly nothing. The Chinese had ransacked all the wood that they could get, the woodwork, the windows, the doors, all the cots and everything. And we were sleeping on cement. We had hardly nothing. And then the officers, Major Hook, came down there and everything. And he came there and he made us put all our food together, and he says, we'll all share alike, you know. And that's what we did. We put it all in one. Whatever we had, some chocolate bars, some chocolate, some, you know, anything that what we had, you know, bully beef and everything. And we started to share that. But then we had nothing to cook the rice. So we burned out some barrels and cooked the rice. And it tasted gasoline and everything. But in the meantime, we were dealing with the Chinamen that come close to the fence. We dared them, and we lured them with money and money is the main topic down there, and we'd give him a jacket or something to have food, you know, because we were short of food. Didn't take, you can't carry that much, you know, for a big bunch of people, and a lot of them didn't have any. And they were shooting at us, all upon the guard would come along, you know, they didn't have that many guards to watch us also, you know. They knew we couldn't run away from them. And so before we'd get organized and all that stuff, so we used to go down there, deal across the fence, boys. Sometimes we'd you know, come on, you give it to me and I'll give it to you, you know. But all at once, you know, we wouldn't, we'd pull it away, and even if we had half, we wouldn't give them the money, you know. So we'd bring it in, and then we'd share it with the others and this and that. Then we didn't have nobody in charge of us. There was no more Corporal Donny. The Kelsos were all dead of Don Company, and we all reorganized in our own section. So then we didn't have a sergeant major or anything. So Major Hook came, he said, so we all voted Longtown, Jim Town, as our sergeant major, you know, acting sergeant major. I don't know if he was paid as a sergeant major. I don't even know nothing of the kind. And I wasn't even paid as a sergeant in the first place, and I was promoted by Major Baird right at near Mount Cameron, because I was always in charge of the guys. This club, he's still here, he's alive, he can tell you how many guys I had under me. He's still alive. And there was Fred Lavallee, he's still alive, he can tell you I was in charge of it. But it doesn't matter, you know. So after that we came there, Chancellor, well, we made the best we could, and then the made us, then we moved, they moved us to North Point Camp. When we came to North Point Camp, there was a few Navy guys and everything. And that was a heck of a place, North Point Camp. It was worse for us, you know. It was very hard to escape from there at that. We were all planning, all the time planning for escape. That Sergeant Payne, you know, he was a heck of a guy, you know, he was a in Jamaica, he was our intelligent officer, acting as, I was a lot with him because he was my platoon corporal, you know. And we used to do a lot of scouting with him, you know. I did lots of that. And I got along pretty good, and then we start to find out where we could get pills or something, you know, because we planned to escape, and guns and all that. We ran out to where all the water goes through from the mountain.
Oh, yeah. Like a culvert.
Yeah, but it's not a culvert. It's not a floodway. Yeah, and we used to go through at night, you know, and go through as far as we could, but we had to come and report back, you know, for the roll call, you know, and all that stuff. So you didn't have that much time. I would have liked to get to where I buried that, but you know, you have to dodge. Sometimes we couldn't go very far and come right back because it was well guarded.
This was from North Point.
Yeah, at North Point. There was a shrine there. We used to take a piece of wood and certain things there, you know. We made a cribbage board and a few other things, you know, to pass the time, keep up the fight. And then at North Point Camp, I want to thank a heck of a lot Auxiliary Officer McNeil, and Mr. Auxiliary YMCA Officer of Auxiliary Officer. What's his name now? I forgot his name. And Mr. Archie McKinnon, yes, and all these guys, you know, they used to exercise us. Morrison, you know, that trained the cadets there, he was there, and you know, to encourage. So we started, we made a minstrel play there. I was in the singing group, and then this YMCA officer used to come and give us a cigarette if we'd come down there, and we organized, we sang songs, you know. I was like the Bullfrog Dinner or whatever it was they called it, and there was the Big Geddes and all them. We used to go down and practice that. That's only when you were not working, you know. And we put up a beautiful minstrel show, and these guys, you know, that kept the morale of the boys. Then there's Billy Boulette and all them, you know, they went and formed a fumigator to be able to fumigate. We used to go and pick up a piece of paper, a little stick of wood or anything, to give it to them so they could boil the thing and fumigate all our clothes, you know, to get rid of the lice and everything. There was lice, it was pitiful. You know. Lice, bed bugs and everything, crabs and everything you wanted. Mm-hmm. And
no medicine.
No, and you know, the officers, we had our officers with us and everything in the kind there. And, you know, we had Captain Reed, he was, I couldn't see him, he had to shaking his leg and, yeah, what's wrong with you? And, you know, his leg would be shaking steady. You know, you came there, he'd just kind of console you, help you the best way he can.
He was frustrated.
Well, he couldn't do nothing. You take Major Crawford, you know, that man went through a lot, same thing. And Banfield, you know, that was another one, you know, that went through a lot. And Cunningham, and they were dentists, you know. They'd pull the teeth out of the guys, put water in there and hold them. And well, Staff Sergeant Paul and Cody, they were their assistants, you know.
Did you get beat?
Oh, yeah, I got beat. I got beat down there at North Point Camp. I got kicked in the pants, and then I got, after that's at North Point Camp. And I went to Bourne Road Hospital to get an operation. And I won't tell them what it's all about.
Why were you in trouble?
No, if they thought you were guilty of something, they'd beat you up. You know, it was all that.
Were you in the diphtheria?
No, you see, I was immune to this kind of stuff. The only thing I got was dysentery at the after I came back from Bourne Road Hospital. I got dysentery. I think I would have been with Sergeant Payne to escape. But I got dysentery, I landed down there, and me and Moise used to attend to each other in the dysentery ward.
Mm-hmm.
And that's bad, you know. But I think what my constitution was strong, you know, after I had the operation.
What's that about?
Because
you don't want to talk about the operation?
No.
Okay, fine. It wasn't an injury from the battle.
No, it was because we didn't have nothing to wash ourselves and no soap or anything of the kind, you know. And
so
I think
infection.
It was, no. Well, there was infection, that's what it was.
Yes. So that's fine, I just wondered if it was a battle injury. But
well, I had battle injury, I had my bad back and all that, you know, and shrapnel, I even took some shrapnel not very long ago out of there, and I still think I have some mm-hmm. left, you know. Yeah, but really nothing drastic, no leg cut or anything of the kind,
no.
You know. But beside that, there was, after we went to Shamshapur again, you know, well, I was dealing in North Point Camp, all I could get to try and get some cigarettes, because, you know, there's some of the guys who would sooner smoke, and, you know, the smoke would be more help to them. We take most of the boys in there, you know. There was some that went without, you know, bowel movement for 56 days. And then Paddy Armstrong was one of them, and there was a couple in headquarters. And then the gangrene set in there. You know, they'd see a little pimple, they'd scratch it off, but it wasn't that, it was gangrene. Finally, Paddy Armstrong died in 1942, I believe, in Shamshapur after we left North Point Camp, but he had it right there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was 28 days without no bowel movement, and I'll tell you, it was no fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see, what you eat is mostly water, and then it contracts,
mm-hmm.
and it's all dry ball, and it stays there.
Mm-hmm.
But beside that, after that, when we went to, I was going to escape. We were working on the airport, and I was the head mixer of the cement. Well, I used to put more cement than gravel, and then put gravel You see, and where there's more cement, well, it would break and the airplane would come right there and it'd topple over, you know. But we were going to escape. There was, if we had a chance, well, there was a big blonde fellow that was with what they call gate headquarters, you know, headquarter company. Not grenadiers, but brigade headquarters. And he had been a pilot before, but he was grounded, and that's why he joined the Royal Canadian Army Service Corps, you know. And we were going to go escape when we were there, but I was supposed to take the blocks off, and we'd jump, and there was an airplane that day. All right, I said, we'll go. And I went to go and take the blocks off, but he wouldn't come. And then the Japs saw me. So I said, you couldn't speak to them in English. Most of them couldn't understand. I tried to explain to him, you know, that the block was running away, so that's why I was putting it back. You
did
see?
They fall for it?
They fell to a certain extent. They hit me and they kicked me around, and I got away pretty good, pretty easy, you know. I was lucky. I showed him. I said, the block was moving.
Did you ever get caught in any of your deals by the Japs?
No, but by the Japs. We were dealing with Japanese. We were dealing with Japanese. Everyone down there, like I told you before. I'm not the only one. There were some dealers down there that were making big money out of our boys, you know. So I used to charge them 10%, but I risked my life for it, you know. You can ask Bert Fleming about it. He's alive, and if he...
What did you do? Did you sneak out of camp to get the stuff?
I did. You see, you couldn't go down there and expose yourself. We had... There, I'm going to make a statement here. You can scratch it off anytime you want. But I'm going to make a statement. You couldn't trust nobody but Canadians, if you were a Canadian. You couldn't trust nobody. But... You see, and that was the reason. I sneaked in, I had to go and get that quinine that time for tacky. That's a little Japanese for Mosin. And if I would have had the money and I could have reached tacky, I would have brought him back to Canada, because that guy did a lot of good for our boys. And a lot of the boys, what I brought in down there, and many times, you know, I never looked to make any money or anything like that. It's just survive, and that was it.
Where did you sneak to get this tacky?
Oh, well, that's contact. I had tacky. I had a little Chan for a while, but he was a crafty little fellow, you know. And I used to get, like, their gold ring. I even made myself a scale. And I used to weigh it. There's Bill, I forgot his name now. He saw me a lot of it, because he had to help me sometimes to hide my stuff, you know, when the inspection had to come. Fleming was just the same thing, and a few others like that, you know. Look, Aki, he's dead now. He couldn't say very much about. And Del Fisher is another one, you know. But I used to come, and you had a jacket to sell or something of the kind. We had... Dr. Gray, he was a pathologist. He was a specialist in the world, you know. He was a personal friend of mine. He came in there. What he could sneak in was silk stockings. And he used to get rid of so many only as he needed something for him to survive, you know. He's the one that told me. He says, I said, Dr. Gray, I says, why do you go around, I said, with your head down? He said, did you ever see a penny in heaven? He said, you always see them on the ground.
And then you used to come to the Japs
with that stuff, and I'd get the money. But what we didn't want was money.
You want cigarettes?
We want not only cigarettes. I got in soy sauce, soybeans, all kinds of stuff. Oh, I can't name it all to you. You know, sugar, brown sugar, and everything. You know, that made the boys, you know, you just put a little bit. But you couldn't get salt. That's something that was just as sacred as wood was. You know, you couldn't get salt. You couldn't get no salt at all of that. But, I dealt in everything there was. You know, we stole some of their paper and we sold it. But, of course, I was brought on the mat by my own people. At North Point Camp, you know, I made a sarcastic remark. You can wipe that off if you want to after. But about one of our officers, you know, he put some buns in his pocket and I didn't like it, and I made a little fuss about it, so they put me in jail there for jail upon jail, and I was only on very small rations. And Sailor Morgan, a personal friend of mine, used to come and sneak me the odd smoke in there. I was there for 3 weeks. Same thing in Sham Chapeau. That time about the paper, I got brought in down there. I spent 3 weeks and beat up and everything. They didn't recognize me when I came out.
Did I was beat you up there?
Oh, yeah, they did. That was in 1943.
That was over a
theft
of paper.
Pardon?
It was over a
theft
of paper?
Yeah.
And were you the only one involved?
Oh, no, there was lots. There was, Morris Pearson was involved in that. Well, you know, I'll tell you what. They took us. Now, nobody's involved in nothing. You know, we couldn't squeal on each other or anything. Nobody knew. Everything is done in the dark in the first place, you know, and it's black. And it's done when it's raining and everything. You take, like when I got caught in the field down there, bring that quinine. I didn't have that quinine because I dropped it in the field. But I was supposed to, I was blind in the prison camp, you know. I was, oh yeah, partly blind. I could just discern a person. And for a while there, I couldn't move at all, you know. I was, it was just seemed like a blur, you know. I'd recognize the voices and the steps, and I could detect the B-29s when they were way before they could detect it with their detectors. I could feel the vibrations, like, you know. I don't know. I think, you know, I was a bushman all my life, you know, and that's what made me, I think, you know, you get a kind of a, I don't know, like something like a dog instinct or
don't
something.
You think that malnutrition made
you blind? Oh, the blind, yes. Malnutrition did that. But I was told that years ago, you know, that if you did that, and I used to lean the sun, you know, and, you know, it came to my mind, and you do that a lot until your eyes cry. Mm-hmm. And look at the sun, and until your eyes cry. And I think that's what brought me back.
Yes,
I think so. But I heard that. That's an Indian. Yes. But then I got, that time I got beat up there by getting, you know, I was in the 7-7 and they brought me and I had to. They never took you out to go to the lavatory. So you did that in one corner and you cleaned your place yourself. And if they want to come and get it, then you slept in the other corner and ate in the other corner, but you had nothing, just a grass mat, and that was it. And not even water to wash yourself. You had, you know, like a little can of water to bring tea. It was mostly water, but it took long. It was boiled, because we had to boil all the water there and everything. And after that, well, we stayed at Sham Chapeau, and I worked and dig tunnels and worked at the racetrack making gardens and, oh, well, I was in the agony ward, you know. There was 69 of us. One time, one guy was dead and the rats were after him already. We hadn't noticed that he was dead, you know. It was the second day that he was dead. They used to take out of agony ward between 5 and 6 guys a day. And it was practically during that the terror epidemic. There was no hopes for us, you know. That's where I took Big Mason there. I was there with Amy Paul, 2 Shaler boys, and Sergeant Frome. Oh, I can't name them all to you right at present, you know. Amy Paul and I used to put ourselves on our back and. I used to fool around with his feet, you know. He'd lay that way and he'd fool around with my feet and I would try to put to sleep that way. That was the only way. This hot feet is something that I don't wish it on my worst enemy. I don't want to have enemies. It's, and I took...
You survived the agony war,
I survived. In 1943, they moved me to another quarter. But then I always had something with my stomach, and I don't know what it is today, and I believe it was all nerves, because I was always on tension, you know. Oh yeah, we cooked our own stuff, you know. Well, the first time I brought some garlic in, and there was Corporal Harrison, he wouldn't have nothing to do with garlic, and I think that was the first time we went to a work party, and I brought some garlic back, and I'll tell you right straight, after that everybody was looking for garlic that they could get, and I tried to bring as much garlic as I could get in the camp, because I think that was saved us from lots of epidemics, you know. I've seen one, for 3 days we didn't have any wood, and we went and dropped trees down, and we used to go down there and for something, you know, and get the small roots. And that's a kind of a camphor. It's like a jack pine, but a camphor wood at that. And it would taste camphor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we used to chop that and put that with our rice.
Mm-hmm. Must have a bit of protein.
Yeah, well, anything. Mm-hmm. You know, the corn, we didn't take the corn cobs. You know, we take the corn and smash it. We're the first one that built gardens down there. You give credit to the Canadians for that, you know. We were the ones that made those gardens on there, and everybody said, oh, they're going to steal it off you. After a while, you know, everyone involved themselves in it, in the camp, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were not running the show. Some of them, the first Canadian parcel, you know, we saved for our tomatoes. Well, if one grain would come out of it, you know, of the tomatoes that we received. We received 2 2/3 parcel of Red Cross parcel while I was in prison camp. That's exactly per person while I was in prison camp. And we were right there where they had, and it was all going rotten. Yeah, and it was stored at Champs Pool. One time, you know, we went to go down to get some food, and we saw there was some fish and it was rotten. Bring it to the camp. You know, the vultures were following us.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought it down there, and I ate that fish. I'll tell you, it was cooked. We ate that fish. And you know, most of our rice had little stones in it and had little white worms. But we ate that, you know. I mean, you couldn't go down there and pick it off, you know, because they had only so much.
And those worms had protein.
No, we ate that. You know, after they're cooked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But about this affair of, I ate a seagull, I caught it, you know, I threw a thing in the air when it was seagull, and there was something at the end, there was a little hook, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I caught a seagull, we skinned it, and I had it boiled, you know, by Popoloff. And a few sparrows, and then we'd eat that, you know. We caught a pig. By a fellow by the name of McLean, he used to work at the stockyard, found out how we could, you don't know that you can lift a pig and he won't squeal.
Okay.
Yes, and that's not a tall story.
Oh,
that you lift him up and he won't squeal from underneath.
Yeah.
And we brought a little pig, and when we passed by there, we threw him in the yard, and then the boys came down there. He went in the pot, bristle and all.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling me. That was that another crazy McLean. And there's some other boys you take, like Hank Belts and Jock Israel of the Royal Rifles of Canada, you know. They were good little signs here. I used to go down there, and you know, they bring up the morale of the people, you know. We put up some shows, like Sonny Castro, he acted as girls. There was 3-4 of them down there that acted as girls. And honest to goodness, I'll tell you, they really put on a good show. Like Guy Faulkner put out the Blue Rose, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was wonderful. We put quite a few shows. And you know, we had no lighting system. Now you wouldn't know how we made it. Everybody worked at it. We shined these things that we use for our doors. And we shine them, and we put it against the sun, and like mirrors, you know.
And that's how we had the
lighting system in there, and it was fantastic. We invited the Japanese to come and see it. They really put on some place. In fact, some of the officers, you know, they thought the guys were real girls at Barga. They were pursuing them.
I saw Neil Bardell was connected with those
shows. Oh, yeah. Neil Bardell and Corrigan, they used to come down there in Agnew Ward. They didn't care if they would catch the disease or anything of the kind. And there was two brothers also, two brothers. No. Two brothers. McKnight used to come too, but there was two other brothers. They worked with the medical there. Pierce brothers or something like that. You know, they should have had more than, you know, I mean, recognition, because they did a lot. And Sergeant Gurr and Mousy and Sonny Veal, they worked with the medical all the time, you know. And there was Corporal Bailey of the Royal Army Medical Corps. He's the one that the Japs made him pull my toenails right off. No anesthetic or anything. It was stupid. I pulled my toenails off, you know, because they were all crumbling.
Did that hurt?
Well, it hurts. Mm-hmm. I can suffer lots, you know, today, mm-hmm. and everything, of course, you know. And most of us boys can suffer more than the average. We suffer every day. But, you know, we were so used, there was no use of complaining about it, that today it's just the same thing. And when we come, it has to be drastic. They don't believe us mm-hmm. today. You understand? Mm-hmm. But after that, you know, we spend the time there. Oh, and then the Canadians were the first one out, the first one that put out the flag. And not, we represented 27 different flags in there when they came through.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And before that, you know, there was two Americans, and they were going to shoot them. And we, the Canadians, this is no fooling. We had a fellow of the Royal Scots, Colonel White, I think was. He took over the command. Although he wasn't senior, there was a Middlesex senior to him, but the other guy wouldn't do it. He took over, and there was the Price brothers. And by golly, you know, we listened to them, and the Price brothers were really wonderful. And that Captain White of the Royal Scots was real good, you know. I'll tell you right straight. And we went right down there and posted our stuff right in front of the Japanese. We wouldn't let them shoot these two Americans. They had caught them. They were by the Pearl and the White River. They were kind of spying on all the shipment and everything, you know. And we saved them from going. There was a sergeant also, you know. We used to have communications. And there was Lorne Disper. He was a radio operator, you know, a technician, you know. He knows about everything. And he made a radio. He used to ask us to go and get steal a part of it. If there's a wreck there, you just put your hand there, grab a hold of it, and pull. And you're going to get it, and bring it in. And that's how we receive all communication. He used, Lorne Disper, he was with the Americans. Then I was interpreter for some French. There was the Free French down there, Cyril Paul and Paul something else. And there was Captain Lepage. And I was most of the time their interpreter, you know. They couldn't speak English, you see, they were Free French guys. And there was a few Americans there. They got caught in there, but they were with merchant ship. And Lorne Disper.
You didn't go to Japan?
No, I didn't go to Japan. No, and I stayed down there because I couldn't walk.
Your legs really were bad.
Oh, yeah. So I got hit on the head with one of these, you know, these books that they call with binders, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Got hit on the head and knocked me out because I couldn't stand straight on the parade square to take the roll call. And that Kamloop kid came and hit me straight on the head and knocked me out.
Mm-hmm.
He was stupid, that's all he was. You had him?
I think we have him now.
Boy, you should get him.
Okay, now tell me, where were we?
Well, I was still in prison camp, you know. We were But there were some atrocities, you know. You take, like, there was a woman when I was at North Point Camp. You know, she was passing by, we saw her going, and then the Japanese stopped her. She was just going down there, and she kind of argued with them a little bit, and then they went down there and tied her to a pole. She had a little baby on her back. And that, I've seen a few atrocities, but that was the worst one then, you know. And they went down there, and she was calling him names or something, I don't know, because I couldn't say nothing. All at once, one went down there, and he went and bayoneted her. And I suppose he hit the little child. And she was tied up, and she was trying to reach him. You know, the little child. She couldn't reach him or anything. So that happened somewhere around 5, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. I couldn't say exactly. But it was before sunset. They used to go down there, and at sunset, you know, they used to climb on a rock at North Point Camp there and sing, you know, and sing to the sun, you know, all the soldiers. And so that was just before the setting sun, you know. And that night she was down there, and she's... the next day we went to work, you know, we were working at Kai Tak Airport, and we were building that Kai Tak. They demolished the whole mountain. They call it the Sacred Mountain, you know. I believe that's where we got, you know, we used to dig up bones and everything. I think that's where we came to. That's where the Chinamen used to bury their dead, you know. And I think that's where the diphtheria epidemic started, you know. I'm not too sure about that. But we made go-karts in there to, instead of hauling it on our back, you know, with a bamboo pole and two baskets, you know, to haul the earth down there. We made a kind of a track and put the four wheels, then we made some kind of brakes, you know. I'll give credit to the Canadians, not because I'm a Canadian or anything of the kind, but we're more alert on all these things for survival, especially in my generation. I don't know about this generation now today, you know. We even had brakes on there. Some guys got killed there, you know, on these things, because all at once the brake is a stick with brake, you know, or something of the kind. But this woman there, we went to work at that Kai Tak Airport, and then we came back, and she was still there that night.
Where was the baby?
The baby was still on her back. And that was one night and one day. So we went the next day. We went again, you know. Now, I don't know. I've seen them bayonet her once. I can't say. Some say that they bayoneted her more, but I can't say. Some of our officers saw more of it. I think Neil Bardell could tell you more about it, you know. And then, you know, we went to work the next day, and we came back in here. She was laying at the end of our prison camp, you know, on that side. You see, there's the seashore, there's the road there, and she was on that side. She was about here from the post, and she was still alive, going like that. And when we came back, we went to go and see her, but I couldn't stand it, you know. She was there. Then there was another atrocity that I didn't go very much for. They stripped the poor little guy stark naked, right in at that same place.
A
Chinaman. And they bayoneted him. They thought he was a gorilla. Maybe he could have been, because there was Chinese gorillas around there, you know. And they made him stand with his hands up, and his leg was tied up to the pole, and he had to hold a board like that. And he lasted, and when he cried, they'd come and slap him. If he dropped the board down, and this and that, they'd slap him. Finally, they killed him, you know, with bayonet. There was another one, you know, that they tied at Shamshpo camp. He was dealing with us across the fence, you know, and they caught him. Well, you know, if they thought they were gorillas, Chinese gorillas, because the Chinese gorillas here, they were built, and, you know, they could salvage or anything of the kind, you know, better, you know, hardy people. He used to, so they tied him under a tap and let the water hit him on the head. And that was at Shamshapo, where you enter over here, and that was by the buildings there. You know, but there was nobody living in that these quarters, or except they were Japanese. And that's bad, you know. And then one time we went to a working party, and at Peninsula Hotel, they tied some of our men there. And today I can't recall their names or anything, but they were Canadians and some British guys. And they went down there and they tied them to the pole, and there was two men that were at the end of a barbed wire, and two men that way, and they'd seesaw through them. That's right in front of the Peninsula Hotel. Well, you see, like the Peninsula Hotel would be facing this street, she was on this side, but it was about there, you know, at the entrance of that other street that went, I think it was after one end or something like that.
So you see that in
the Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's, no, that's authentic. Yeah. That's as true as I'm telling you the story right now. with our boys, they beat them up. Novak. Same time that Peterson got beat up that time too. Peterson stood his beating up, and they pounded on him. He'd get up to take some more. Mm-hmm. While the other one was yelling, so they beat him up worse, you know, because they hated cowards, mm-hmm. you know. Oh, well, that was Fred Lavallee, not Fred Lavallee, Leo Lavallee. You were talking about the Lavallees.
Yeah.
There's another. They come from Santa Tau. There's about seven brothers. Well, this guy, you know, when he is murdered, he was with the Holiday, and he's a kind of cheer. I mentioned him before, you know, at the Battle of the Sun Sun. He was about a 6'2". Tall guy, he was Don Company also. And they were all tied up and everything, and they had to stop on account Swanson couldn't follow. He was shot in the leg, you know, and they were had him as prisoners, and with Holiday and Lavallee, they were buddies, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, Lavallee was the type of a guy, he was always smiling, you know, mm-hmm. all the time, and they thought he was laughing at him. And I believe that started the whole thing, you know. Because he was fearless, young chap. But Anatrastis, it was nothing for them. Then there was one guy that was slap happy. He used to be pretty dirty on us. He hit me also, and so did this crazy guy. All at once, he'd take a fit. One night, I was out, you know, to go to the lavatory, and you know, you had only two places to go for lavatory, and that was for the whole camp. You couldn't go like that because it's dangerous, you know, to get sickness out of it. And he came down there across me, and he slapped me, and well, of course, slapping, you know, he didn't kill me, and that's it, you know, that as long as you took it, then that was it, you know. We had a few boys, you know.
Were Seifel
there? Who?
Seifel?
And there was Sergeant Major Sato.
Japanese.
He was very good to the Canadians, and you know, we went and paid him a homage. When we were liberated, we went down there to see him. He was in prison camp with Doc Crawford and all them, because he was a very nice man, you know. He was very good to us. I mean, you know, as much as he could. He was a kind of a minister, that man, you know, Protestant minister or something of the kind, you know, but he was a sergeant major. And we used to go on working parties. And he was in charge, and you know, treated us kind of human. Then we had another fellow, we used to call him Jojo. He was pretty good with us. I was working with a fellow from, what do you call that, across from Kenora? Kuwait. No, that's way further. Right across on CNR line. Not that. They call that. He come from there. His name was. Right now I can't give you his name, but we were working underground, him and I, and we had to bridge a slip in the tunnel, you know, and we're bridging that with bamboo poles, you know, and then bring it up down there, and we'd go around it. So, because all this mountain is not solid rock, it's more like shale and sand all mixed up, you know. And it came down, and all at once I heard it coming down. I said, let's go down. His name was, maybe it'll come back. But we ran down, and I passed through, but I was only buried this way. And we had to crawl under these bamboo affairs, you know, they were about that high. And he was buried down there up to here. And Jojo gave me a hand to take him out. But, you know, we were just knocked out. The wind was knocked out of us. But me, not so much, because I had only my legs buried up. But him, he had all part, only his head was out. He helped me to undo them. But when we were at these working parties, it was nothing. Now, they want to know why, you know, we complain a lot about our backs and everything. It was nothing for them. They used to come, and you'd be walking, and they'd come with their rifles, and they were just the right height, you know, and they hit you with the butt of the rifle, and would hit you in the back.
Like a baby.
Yes. And, you know, it went like this, you know, you couldn't help. And that was a lot of that. And then one time, well, I think I mentioned that before, but there was the big battle in January, I think, 1945, or February it was now, the exact date now I can't remember, when all the Americans came over and they bombarded down there. At the beginning of it, started about 7 o'clock in the morning. It was what was his name from Swan River? He had only one arm, redhead boy. He wanted to see the whole thing, but he got caught in the parade square and he had to stand there. Because the Jap caught him and they made him stand there, and he went through all this all day long there, you know. Through the bombing and shelling of the camp, I think, about 6 casualties there only in my region. I don't know about the others, you know, and then there was the officers' camp. And, you know, that guy stood all the way through down there, through it, you know. And he comes from Swan River. He was red ahead, and now, just because I want to mention his name. But, and he stood there, and you should have seen, when they came down there, it was just like an inferno going, you know, the tracer bullets, you know, shooting at ours. And our guys were diving right in there. Well, they were Americans. I don't know who they were, you know. And some didn't make it, you know, and they turned off. One guy went right opposite our place. And by golly, you know, they went down there. They were looking for the boat. I don't know if he drowned or whatever it was that happened, but we didn't hear any more about it. But I think we caught it. They lost about 14 planes there. But they ransacked the whole shebang. And one time in about 3 minutes, the B-29 came down there and they bombed the whole dockyards. That lasted about 3 minutes. But the camp was still shaking after they were gone, you know, from the vibration of these bombs. And then one time, 2 P-38s came down there and bombed they bombed a few of boats, but they went and bombed the oil tanks. And you should have seen that the tops were flying up and it burned for weeks. We had to go and work parties down there, you know, to keep the fire only in one region, you know. Yeah. And all we had lots of... when we were out before that, the first guy that really went out of the camp was Bert Fleming. Bert Fleming went out. Well, he didn't do very much because he was a sick man in prison camp, you know. He had a heart condition. And we took care of him. We used to give him a little extra. We didn't know what it was. I think it was mostly nerves today that they found out. They thought we had sick hearts, but it wasn't the hearts, it was the nerves. But I think he was the first one that went out. And then when he came back in, showed me the place, and then I went out, and I'm not the only one. There was quite a few of us, and we went through the town. That's before our task force was around yet. But we heard at the working party, after I got that jaw of mine broken, it beat me up, you know, on account of these eggplants. I think I mentioned that. Well, I went down there, we were working at the working party, and And there were some eggplants, you know. And I saw them, and we had to haul that dirt. So I went and put my shirt on, because we only work in a tandushi, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. That's all, and sandals, and bare feet, and shoes, whatever you could get. And here I saw those eggplants. I said, boy, that'll be good for tonight. So I put my shirt on, and I went and picked them up. I didn't see no guards around, but there was one on top of the hill. He saw me, and when I came down and ready to go, he came and he picked me right up and right down there. Pee, pow, pow, and he found these things, and pow, pow, pow. And they busted my jaw, you know. And that's why when I came back, I had a little hard time, you know, to eat yet. You know, I was taking only, I didn't eat solids, you know, all the way through, you know. But everything is all right. But I'll tell you right straight, I really got a beating that time, too. But
how long was that beating last?
Not very long, because they used their rifle butts or hoses. When Crawford was being hit, it was with a rubber hose, and they used to put lead or whatever, a piece of pipe in there. They couldn't reach Crawford because he was so tall, you know, right on the parade square, and they hit him straight in the face, you know. Mm-hmm. And a little wee sort of guy, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all, Crawford could have eaten about 10 like them before breakfast. But it was pitiful, you know, a big man like him. And he was doing, he never did nothing wrong, you know. But it was just, that was their habit, you know. We used to steal, I used to go and work, you know, and then I was building a road there from at Cham Chapeau, from their headquarters, you know, to the guardhouse. And they had to walk in water, so we were hauling that with a wheelbarrow, kind of makeshift wheelbarrow, and we were crippled guys, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were building a road, and there was some tomatoes, little tomatoes. They look like the ones we have at home, you know, but let's say like a little plum. We used to steal them. And then put them in the wheelbarrow, throw the bag down there, and bring them and throw the wheelbarrow. But we take the bags and take them down. Well, then we used to put that with our rice, you know. I'll tell you, you know, if you gathered enough. Another thing there's not only me, but if I could have a chance to go to the pig farm, we used to raise pigs there. Mm-hmm. Well, when we raised these pigs, that was for them, you know, mm-hmm. and everything. And I think they gave us some one time for Christmas, or two times, I think it was, you know. And they went and made, Popoloff was our cook, you know, and he made certain special dish, and it was a great thing, you know. One time he made some bread, well, it tasted better than all the cake you want to eat, you know. And things like that, you know. Take like that fish when it came, that rotten fish I said before, you know, that was something fantastic. There's another thing, we have to give a lot of credit to Salvation Army, because Chinese Salvation Army saw to it that we had 15 pounds of salt brought into the camp, which was something we didn't have. Then I was working on the fields, salt beds that we made to gather some salt, but that was practically at the end of the internment camp, you know. We made one bed there, and then another one a little lower, another one a little lower, and you had to haul all that stuff and make it higher and higher up to the bottom, you know. There was five beds. Then we take buckets of water from the ocean and dump it in there, and would go through there, and then it would dry up, you know, and penetrate through, and then the salt stayed on top in the sun. You couldn't do that. You had to do that during the summer months, you know, when there's no monsoon or anything. We gathered up some salt, but it didn't last that long. You see, after that we were kind of liberated. That was sometimes in the month of May and June, mostly of 1945. I worked on these salt pits there, you know, to make salt for the camp and things of the kind, yeah. But after that, we were liberated. Well, when we were liberated, I went with Staff Sergeant Cote. They sent a few guys of us. We went to the Stanley camp, opposite where they thought, and we went to see, and the girls to entertain us. There were some beautiful girls, but you know, we were not. But and they took us to the beach and everything. Well, of course, You know, I couldn't even get in the water, I'd get a cramp, you know. We're shy of water in the first place. And then they told us, they thought they heard them, that it was Sergeant Green that was, you know, massacred. That was a massacring camp, a Stanley camp down there. But not theirs. That was where the internees were.
Yeah.
You know, not prisoners of war, they were prisoners.
Yeah.
You know, like us, we were prisoners of war, but they were civilian prisoners. You know?
They were with us.
There was an old man that married a young girl, 16, and everything of the kind there, you know. Then they loaded us. Well, I went down there. I was with Bill Scrumido and the Swede Anderson, and I guess Swede Anderson can verify that statement. Bill Scrumido, he's coming this summer. He's going to come and see me. I was best man at his wedding, so he should come and see me. He comes right to Oak Bank, and now his father-in-law is going to tell him about me, where I live. But we went out, you know, that's before our troops came in yet. So I saw the man that signed the peace, and I went into there, and there was a safe full of yen, about this size, not quite this size, but practically. And there was the guys there. They knew they were finished, because we heard on the 9th of August that they were destroyed, practically, you know, down there. And that's through the grapevine. And I said, you're free, and some white people came out, and some Chinese, and they knew that the Japanese were finished. So we went down there, and I took some yens, millions of yens, you know. And I loaded it in there. But Bill Scrumido and the Swede, they disappeared. They didn't want to have nothing to do with me. I loaded that up on with the Chinaman that had the tricycle, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I practically lost my life there, because all the Chinese saw all that money, they were chasing after me, they would have killed me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing, you know. I have to throw it like you throw meat to the wolf to stop him for a certain time. I had lots of it. I had lots when I come to Vancouver, but I gave some in Manila and all over. I gave some to all the boys and everything. I had lots of that stuff, you know. And after that, you know, I went with Bill Scrumido and that the Swede, and we went to where the Japanese Navy guys were. They stood there, they were guarding, because they didn't want to be attacked by the Chinese, you see. I went right through down there, you know, to get some swords and everything. I only came out with two of them, you know. That's all I could get. But another time I knew where the Sergeant Major Sato was. I went in there, and I came back with an armful of things. But that was the curfew night when all our troops were in. Then the Prince Robert was the first one that came in. But I'm going too fast with my story. But we came from Stanley Gap, and that's when our troops came in, you understand. And they were fighting in Hong Kong, and the Canadians had taken Kowloon, and they didn't fire. They didn't have to fire or anything of the kind. And just the same, I went out the second night. I used to go to the ship, and I brought Petty Officer Smith. You know, I gave him a sword. I had three of them, you know. I gave him a sword, and there was some diamonds on there, you know, these things. They were Semeraz or whatever you could. And we used to go to the Prince Rupert ship, or the Ontario, and they used to feed us all who wanted, but I was on liquid, and Chief Petty Officer, and in fact, the captain there, he was not supposed to do that, and you know, they were short of rations, they had to load up, and they wouldn't let them, you know, and then they had made them move off the shore, so we couldn't go down there. Anybody that wanted to eat, you know, just had to go on these ships, you know, and after that, they called them back, I don't know. But that's all. Cote and I and Captain Cunningham, we went out and we tried to get my sword back, because the British took it over. They shot at me, and they took all my swords. They said to me, they gave me a slip, but I never received these swords that I had taken.
And those guys wanted the souvenirs.
Yeah, but Captain Cunningham was there with me, would try to get these swords back, you know. But after that, they loaded us on the 9th of September. I was loaded on the Empress of Australia. So they loaded us on there. We were sleeping on the deck in the hammocks and this and that. One of our boys died there, and I forgot who it was. Really, I forgot who it was. But we were loaded with these internees, you know. Mm-hmm. There was women there and men and everything and the kind. And then they brought us to Manila. And you should have seen Manila. We came there, and then they drove us in trucks. There was food supplies, you know, about 6 miles long and about a mile wide, as high as a big crane could pile it up. And then they loaded us up. That's all kinds of stuff, clothing and everything of the kind, you know, ammunition and everything, you know. So they brought us to a camp, and they were building them as we were coming in, you know. That was an American camp. And they fed us down there. We could have anything. So they gave us $200 there. American money. That's the first money we saw, you know. Well, of course, you couldn't even buy anything. I'm not kidding you. The Americans were so good, you know. You'd come to the canteen to buy something. You could have everything. And you should have seen the medical we went through when we went in there. That night, we were going through, and they were test your blood, test everything. Already, you know, we had ate some, so we were a little fatter than what we were, you know. Because the last time they weighed me was 96 pounds, and that was in 1943. They wouldn't weigh me anymore after, you know, you lost so much, you know. And I weighed 182 when I went in the camp. Moise, I believe, he went down to about 76, and he weighed about 200 pounds. And there was others like that, you know. Yeah, and I should go home. Yeah.
Well,
deliberation,
you told me. I mean, we
could
continue this,
but... They loaded us on a, it won't take very long. They loaded us on a, what they call a hospital ship from Manila. And then when we came back, like houses and streets, you know. There were so many ships there. And then we stopped at Marshall Group and another island. And then we stopped at Pearl Harbor, and that's where I met Jerry Shoemaker, an American Marine. I have a picture, I believe, at home, yeah. He's a tough guy. He took me off the ship that time, and we went down there to see the hula hula girls, but we came back, you know. We had a ride with two quacks. But we came back on the ship, and then when we were coming back, then... that's where Corporal Slow Jackson died, you know. I don't know what he died of. I couldn't tell you, but he died, and we buried him, and it was Corporal Downey, Sergeant Downey, really. He was the one that gave us the... And I was on the firing squad. We buried him this side of Pearl Harbor, you know, before he reached home. He came from Kenora somewhere, Ontario. That was Slow Jackson, and he was a good guy. And then when we arrived here, you know, the two thing in that Squamout, you know, the boys were to disembark. You know, we couldn't. You know, it was fantastic. You know, you cried. We went right down in the back in the boat, and we couldn't come out.
You were so emotional.
Yeah. But then mm-hmm. We cried. Came up and I kissed Mother Earth. And I'm not the other.
Were your mother in the final?
No.
Came with
it. Yeah.